Hello and welcome to History Hack. I'm joined today with my good friend Beth, and we've got something slightly different. We're normally military historians, but we're going to a completely different part of the world and era for this today. Beth, do you want to tell us some more about who we're joined with?
Yeah, absolutely. As Marcus said, you know, we're military historians by trade. So this topic is really quite something new for us. And actually, having had a look into it, it's actually really interesting. We're joined by Teresa Folger-Naidu, who is an historian and assistant professor at the Polish University abroad. And she's head of the African research there. And where Teresa is going to be taking us today is Africa. She's going to be taking us to South Africa, with focusing on the Indian diaspora in South Africa, which is a really, really interesting topic. And she's written loads on the subject, including a title called The Tripolar Culture of Durban, a South African Metropolis, and Hindu Spiritual Culture of Durban. So, Teresa, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to History Hack.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
Wonderful.
Just to start us off, can you take us back to about 1860 when the Indians start to arrive? What was the thought process behind it and the motivations for them coming to South Africa?
Yes, the true Indian Odyssey in South Africa began in 1860. Although the history of Indian diaspora in South Africa dates back to 17th century, when the first settlers came to Cape Colony, invited by the Dutch East India Company. But from 1860, I can say present history of South African Indians began. On November 16 that year, the first British ship, SS Truro, carrying 342 Indian passengers from Madras, India, arrived in South Africa, and that event marked the beginning of a long and, I can say, painful period in the history of Indian diaspora in that region. 10 days later, another voyage of Belvedere from Kolkata ended at Port Natal, carrying as well 342 passengers on board. The largest group of workers arrived in South Africa between 1860 and 1911, and they arrived as indentured workers. They were employed by the British colonial government to work on sugarcane plantation in the Natal colony. It was approximately 152,184 indentured Indians arrived within that 50-something year period, which marked total of 384 trips by the ships. The last ship, called the Mlazi, arrived in July 1911, and it was like it marked the end of the notorious system of indenture. When the British Empire started ruling southern tip of Africa, they began to recruit in mainly sugar industry. They began to recruit indigenous people, and in that case, they were Zulus. Hmm. Although the colonial authorities were not initially aware that Zulu men considered agricultural work as a typically female work. So due to the high turnover of local workers, colonial authorities had to reach for the help of Indian workers, who at that time proved themselves positively in other British colonies, for example, in Mauritius. Mm. The demand for Indian indentured laborers increased dramatically after the abolition of slavery in 1834. So Indians were sent sometimes in large numbers to plantation colonies producing high-value crops such as sugar, I think sugar mainly, in Africa and also in Caribbean. Mm. So most of the newly arrived in southern part of Africa were employed as indentured workers mainly on sugarcane plantation, but Some of them started working, for example, in coal mines, while others choose to work as domestic help. What interesting is that following the indentured workers to the colony of Natal also arrived so-called free passengers. They were called free because they paid for their trips on their own. They searched for the opportunities to trade or to run their own businesses. And in 1880s, about 15% of the total Indian population of South Africa at that time came from northern India, mainly from Gujarat region, which is located in northeast. Many of them were traders, artisans, teachers, or shop assistants. So in a big number, they started arriving since 1869. So that was the main reason why such a big number of Indians is present in South Africa till today.
Yeah, it was a huge number, and there's still a huge number living there as part of the African
continent. Yeah. So that was something, you know, I never really thought of it that way. You know, they're going as these free passengers, as you say. That's something that's really interesting. And as you mentioned, Teresa, they settle in the colony of Natal, but they do struggle to survive in this new environment, don't they? It's a completely new set of conditions for them, isn't it?
Yes, that's true. Even before they reached the African shore, life for those recruits on the ships was, I can say, horrendous. The voyage towards the unknown, because that was completely unknown place, was very often difficult. There are many records of the Indians being, for example, abused, humiliated by the ship's captains or doctors or even the crew. Women, especially the single women, traveled in fear for this day. When they arrived in Natal, they found that proper housing was not prepared for them. So that was the first obstacle. They started erecting shacks, for example, made from the simple materials like leaves or branches. Those temporary living places did not protect them, for example, from weather or from illness. Also, medical assistance was lacking. It took many years before the employers provided decent accommodation in the form of barracks. It was like one big barrack built for example, four families. So at the beginning, the living conditions were very difficult. Their wages also were very low. Often they were not paid at all, or the payment was delayed. Plantation owners often extended working hours in the, which was very difficult in the heavy, hot climate of Natal. The owners of the plantation introduced severe punishments on those who could not fulfill a large number of daily duties. So the Indians had to make many adaptations with regards to culture, religion, language, dress, food, in order to survive in the new land. While in foreign country, they came into contact with foreign culture and had to learn languages. Not every person could cope with the strict requirements, but those who fulfilled the terms of a four-year contract, at the end, they became free landowners because they were promised, after the contracts are finished, they were promised a piece of land to settle. What defined Indian immigrants was their fashion, religion, the culture, specific religious objects, even kitchen utensils or spices, clothes that they preferred to import from their own country. which resulted in spread of the development of Indian trade in Africa. And it was, that's why those free passengers started coming, just mainly for the trade. Coming from different parts of India, they represented as well different languages, cultures, and traditions. They were Christians, they were Muslims, but the vast majority were Hindus who belonged to different castes. Those indentured workers were generally speaking languages like Tamil, Telugu, Hindi, Bengali, while the group of free traders spoke Gujarati and Urdu. Representing different social circles, in exile in Africa, they tried to live in equal communities. In 1911, when the system of hiring contracted workers ended, those who survived to the end of the terms were offered either free return to India or alternatively a chance to settle in South Africa as free citizens. So the majority of them decided to settle in Africa. It was still better for them than coming back home to India.
And just as a little aside to that, when you say a lot of them chose to stay, would many of them have chosen because they maybe couldn't afford to get back to India, or would they have been able to get back if they wished to?
The trip was also offered for free, but because majority of those people came from unprivileged communities, if they decided to come back, they had to start everything from the beginning. So it was difficult for them. While in Africa already, they were offered a land so they could settle, and I think that time in South Africa situation, economic situation was a bit better than in India. So
were they true indentured workers? Did they owe a contract? Did they have to do a number of years work to pay for their passage, for example?
No, it was offered to them for.
And that brings us on to the early 20th century, you were saying, about 1911. And this is where lots of people would have actually come across this story, because this is where Mahatma Gandhi started his political activism, wasn't it? So how did that come about? And then can you tell us more about the creation of the Phoenix settlement and why it was called Phoenix and why Phoenix was there?
Yes, that's true. In no time, Gandhi became the leader of South African Indian community. It was in 1893 that Mahatma Gandhi went from India to Natal in South Africa as a young lawyer. He wasn't even 24 years old, just after graduation. He was invited by Indian traders because they were facing some difficulties while working. There was some conflict between European settlers and them. So when he left Africa, he was about 45 years old. It was in 1914, but his popularity began in Durban, in South Africa, but soon after, he was known across the world. While in Africa, Gandhi was able to transform the struggle for the commercial interest into the fight for the rights of all Indians in South Africa. For 22 years, he devoted himself to improving the humiliating conditions in which his Indian compatriots and Africans as well lived. He showed people a new way of fighting against injustice, and that way was without the use of violence. Only this way of proceeding was called the right one. So he wanted to fight for justice, but without using physical violence. On May 2nd, 1894, Gandhi formed the Natal Indian Congress, in which he served as a secretary. It was the first political organization protecting the rights of Indians in Africa. Alternatively, similar organizations with the same goals and aspirations were established in different parts of South Africa. It was Transvaal Indian Congress, Cape Indian Congress, and all of them later merged into one South African Indian Congress, which then began to work closely with the African National Congress, the party which is ruling till today in the country. In 1902, the idea of Satyagraha was born. It was a social non-violent movement seeking to demonstrate Indians' own beliefs peacefully. Gandhi portrayed himself as a seeker of truth through love and non-resistance. Under his leadership, Natal Indian Congress organized two very important demonstrations in 1908 and 1913. During these campaigns, a large part of Indian society manifested its willingness to fight without the use of violence. In the same time, he began working on the publications of the weekly Indian Opinion magazine, and a year later in Durban, he founded the Phoenix Settlement. It was a place where people who assisted him could build a cooperative community. In Phoenix, the community established an international printing press, museum, library, a medical clinic, primary school, and there was also built a house where Gandhi's son lived with his family. Gandhi himself stayed in the settlement for a short time, as he was more involved in his practice in hospital time. Why Phoenix? This district of Durban is located about 20 kilometers northwest of city center, and it was probably the oldest place where indentured workers were settling from the very beginning of their presence in Africa. To create the settlement, Gandhi purchased over 40 hectares of land just for the purpose of that Satyagraha social movement could successfully develop. Life in Phoenix was based on equality manifested in equal wages or possession of 2 acres of land. This settlement played a significant role as a religious and political asylum and a focal point for resistance activists. The most historic place was Gandhi's house. It was located at the top of the settlement. It was named Sarvodaya. It was like a symbol, his house on the top of the hill. A key turning point for the Phoenix settlement was the riot. It was much later, it was in 1985, and which led to the destruction of several districts of Durban, including Phoenix, where the symbolic, traditional and peaceful life of Gandhi family ended. Hundreds of Indian families were deprived of their belongings and had to live in a temporary accommodation for like several months. The Phoenix stands till today, and now it's a large township which is inhabited by a vibrant community of African, but mostly Indian population, still Indian population in South Africa.
So, Teresa, just very quickly before we move on to our next talking point, I just want to bring up, obviously, we've mentioned about Gandhi and his role in with the Indian community in South Africa. But it is, to my understanding anyway, that he did actually make some pretty grim comments about Black Africans. Is that something that you know about? Is something that he, you know, known at the time for making these kind of comments about the native African population?
I think his main reason for coming to Africa was to take care, fight for his people. I think he had that idea in his head, and which developed later to something like fighting for independence in India. And South Africa, they always had, because it's multicultural, there's lots of different people living there, they always had that race issues. It's still present. So I think, I believe that, yes, he might have said things about Africans, I think, but mainly because he was caring for Indian people. He just wanted to Indians to have decent life as well. However, his Indian National Indian Congress cooperated with ANC, but I think that was in later time when Gandhi left Africa. They just somehow found common things to fight together against white supremacy, against apartheid.
Okay, yeah, thank you. So obviously with Gandhi, and then obviously we're moving on, and the Indian population in South Africa does still continue, as you say, to this day. But there's something that happens, isn't there, in the 1950s? There's the Group Area Act in 1950. Well, there's a group of them, isn't there? There's about, is it three of them? But it's the one in 1950 that's really important, isn't it? And what it means for racial segregation in South Africa, and then what it means for those Indian workers as a result of that segregation, because it results in creations of new townships and things like that, doesn't it?
Yes, yes. That in 1950, the apartheid government enacted the Group Area Act. That was law that defined zone of racial segregation in South Africa. So individual racial groups like whites, Africans, colored Indians, and other Asians were separated from each other and placed in different zones where they were ordered to live and work. And as a result of this division, an urban district called Chatswood was created in Durban, especially for the Indian community. Mm. It was for residents in 1964. It's consisting of 11 unit section. It offered 21,000 homes for Indian people. So they were removed from everywhere else in Durban, and they were brought to Chatswood. The main reason why an Indian township of such large size was created was to separate the residential central districts of Durban, inhabited by mostly by Europeans, by colonists, from the enormous African district called Umlazi, which was on the southern part of Durban. So the government, I can say, squeezed the Indian quarter in between. Chatswood was and is a constantly developing urban district, and it's situated at a distance of about 15 kilometers from Durban city center. It currently consists of a dozen smaller districts. They are like small towns. For example, they called Havenside, Bayview, Arena Park, Buffalbosch, Shalcross, and a few more. But they are better known as units. People usually use units, and which are numbered from 1 to 11. For example, Havenside is called Unit 1. Arena Park is called Unit 6. Chatswood next to Phoenix and other places like Verulam, to this day, they gather people of Indian origin. The people of Chatswood, because of the history, because of they were forced to live there, they are very attached to their culture and their tradition because they were living together. So it was easier for them to cultivate the culture. The visible evidence of this is the Temple of Understanding. It's also called the Hare Krishna Temple, which is it was built open in 1985. And until the end of apartheid era, it was a place of awakening faith and hope for the Indian people. And after 1994, when democracy was restored in South Africa, it became symbol of new South Africa. And it was praised by very high state dignitaries, including Nelson Mandela, who was obviously a hope for change that time. That temple is like a symbol for the culture and for resistance of Indian people today. Due to its magnificent architectural style, the temple has become a tourist attraction and is visited by over 2 million tourists every year. The construction of the temple began in 1969 and was designed in the shape of a lotus flower. A few years later, the beautiful gardens were also designed around this temple. And it is that temple is the largest Hare Krishna temple in Africa, and it has earned the reputation of being the most beautiful on the African continent. It remains a spiritual oasis and a retreat for those who want to understand their purpose in life. It's a sanctuary from material chaos and a haven to society. So like a peaceful place where everybody can come and reflect the life. So near the temple, in the central place of Chatsworth, a beautiful park was created with fountains and green alleys and an even small amphitheater to commemorate the 100th anniversary of Mahatma Gandhi's arrival in South Africa. And the park is called Gandhi Cemetery Park. It is located on the hill overlooking the temple, that temple of understanding on one side. And on the other side, there is visible the vibrant shopping district of Chatsworth and also the residential settlements. It's a very beautiful place. Chatsworth is one of Durban's largest and still poorest township or district, we can call. And over the years, it has grown into a cosmopolitan district. And at the moment, it's inhabited by over 450,000 residents in located in 15 neighborhoods. The district is characterized by a variety of architecture, a mixture of old and new styles of building. It exists for the last 5 decades, and thanks to that, it created a specific lifestyle, resulting in the experience of a shared existence of the middle class derived from Hinduism, Christianity, and Islam, as well as from various languages, mostly Tamil, Gujarati, and Hindi. Mm-hmm. Despite being cosmopolitan and diverse in nature, Chatsworth is still dominated by the vast majority of Indians, mm-hmm. who in today, 21st century, without forgetting their culture and heritage, call themselves citizens of South Africa. Mm-hmm.
Sounds very peaceful, especially the temple. Sounds very tranquil and beautiful. Can you tell us a bit more about the culture? You touched on it there, about people who are there and their kind of subculture in the town and how they find themselves more recently as well. How do they celebrate their time in South Africa and their culture? How's it evolved?
Yes, that's true. Many people may not still be aware of the fact that Durban has the highest concentration of Indians outside of India. When they first arrived in South Africa, they brought with them their rich heritage of, for example, delicious spices, and culture and art. But most importantly, they brought their humility, service to all mankind, beautiful traditions, and dedication to labor. Now, 160 years later, these core values remain within the Indian community and have evolved to incorporate values and tenets from all the other diverse cultures around. Today, Indians make up to 2.5% of the population in South Africa and have contributed to not only the diversity of the country, but also the economy. local food in Durban, including the iconic today, I think it's known around the world, bunny chow. Has been created by Indian people, and many famous curry spots in Durban are run by Indians. Bunny chow is a meal. It's a curry which is served in a bread, the hollowed bread. The inside of the bread is taken out, and yes,
delicious,
very tasty.
Yes. Indians as well is not only about the food, but they also run a large number of businesses in Durban and can still be found in former areas like Phoenix, Chatswood, and obviously in a large number. Their profession range from market farmers, shop assistants, municipal workers, to engineers, doctors, and teachers. They also are known to have their own accents and slang, adding to the colorful landscape of South African culture. Today, their main language is English, and although the small number of representatives of the older generation still speak Indian languages, but English is dominant, but it has its characteristic sounds, which is only for that group of population, which over the decades developed a specific language style based on the standard of English language. Number of words and phrases were created as a result of mixing of the linguistic culture of Indian, English, Afrikaans, and African languages. That's the language. It sounds different. It's specific for that group of South Africans. The most important, I mean, not the most important, but one of the important cultural features is also cinema. It became a regular feature for many Indians living in Durban. The films had a positive impact for language retention and became a source of religious education for many of the Indians. Today, Indian movies are still widely watched, and I'm talking about the Bollywood movies. They still are watched by younger and older generations, although most have English subtitles. They don't understand Indian languages anymore. But cinemas regularly screen Indian movies to cater for the huge Indian population in Durban. Their South African Indian film industry is raising as well. There is, in recent years, a few very good movies was made, and reflecting that specific culture and lifestyle of Indians. The Indians in Durban have still contribute greatly towards the growth of whole province. Their festivals, temples, mosques, and culture continue to be a great tourist attraction, mostly today, tourist attraction for whole city. Yeah.
Wonderful. Is it just something that you just started to mention there? And one thing that has always fascinated me, in the area in which I live, is we have a big Indian population up here as well. And the thing that's always fascinated me ever since being a very small child is their celebration of religious festivals. So like Diwali and so on, you know, with all the bright colours. And they're so fabulous to watch. How were such celebrations, how do they carry out those celebrations in South Africa, the Indian community?
It is very similar to what is happening around the world within Indian communities. The majority of Indians that live in Durban are Hindus. In 1936, they were 79% Hindus compared to 14% of Muslims, and even smaller percentage were Christians. Religious culture affected every aspect of life, and because it was part of folk tradition in India, local Hindus were able to transcend regional, cultural, and linguistic differences. The building, for example, of mosques and temples in Natal was an important step in reconstructing religious life, and this became a community centers. Initially, Indians erected tiny temples on the sugarcane estates. The earliest include those at Ambilo Road, Mount Edgecombe, Newlands, Seaview. They were places in Durban. They were like at the beginning, end of 19th century, beginning of 20th century. The temples not only helped preserve religion, but became a source of security for many Indians. It was here where communal worship was experienced. The births, marriages, death ceremonies were observed, and festivals carried out. The mosque, which is also means to build community spirit, became the center of Muslim worship and congregational prayer. The first mosque was built in 1881 in Great Street in Durban city center, and it was built by passenger Indians, so that free traders. And till today, it's the largest mosque in the Southern Hemisphere. It's still serving its worshippers. But because Hinduism was more present than any other religion, I'm going to focus a little bit more on Hinduism. It was mainly thought at home, while temples only served as a source of community bonding. The religion was initially taught by parents, while elders recited mythological stories from Indian literature to the young, and religious stories they were told orally. Indian festivals and rituals are very visible markers of racial and ethnic identity, and they strengthen the links between individuals and the communities in which the people live. So the most important and the most famous festivals, which are still celebrated by Indians, are Festival Kavadi Festival. It's celebrated in February and May each year, and it honors the god Muruga, who Hindus believe has the power to cure people of the illness and get rid of misfortune. Those who have been afflicted with disease or sickness, they fast, pray, and use Kavadi as a means of penance. The Kavadi is made from bamboo, which is from bamboo stick, which is bent into an arch and decorated with marigolds. Also with peacock feathers and palm shoots and coconuts. And there is a container filled with milk, and it's attached to each corner, and which the devotee uses to wash the statues of the deity. The Kavadi festival is a very strong part of Hindu tradition, which continues till today. So another is Mariaman, which is commonly known as a porridge prayers. It's a festival associated with the goddess who is believed to be the cause and cure of various infectious diseases, including smallpox and measles. During this festival, devotees offer cool foods such as porridge milk, or pumpkin or coconut to the goddess Mariam to cool her anger. The food is placed in a bucket around the temple and is eaten by devotees. Another festival called Draupadi It's commonly known as firewalking. It's celebrated annually in March, and it honors the goddess Draupadi, who is regarded by Hindus as the model of duty, love, devotion, and who bore various trails with the great fortitude. The ceremony involves devotees walking through a 10-meter fire. Those who have faith in the goddess believe that she walks the coals before them and cools it. And I think the most known and the most common festival, Diwali, it's as well celebrated amongst Hindus communities in South Africa and I think everywhere around the world. Known as Festival of Lights, it is celebrated at the end of the autumn harvest in India with ceremonial worship of the goddess of wealth and learning. And yeah, as I said, this most known Hindu festival around the world.
It must be quite a sight to see that. You know, with the blend of South African and Indian cultures there, it must be amazing. Can you tell us a little bit more about, as one of the three pillars of Durban's culture, the Indian diaspora, and how that makes up part of the culture?
Culture and heritage, however, is for people of the South Africa great wealth. Although they are firmly attached to their roots, they live in a country where the guiding principle is Ubuntu. It's a philosophical and ethical term derived from the Nguni languages, so the African indigenous, which means humanity, and is interpreted in the same way I am because you are. So that's the main principle, despite all many cultures present in the country. Durban has a special place on the metropolis, located at the tip of the African continent, plays an important economic, political, and cultural role. The city has a cosmopolitan status because it is dominated by a mixture of cultures that shaped its common history. Durban's tripolar culture has a strong impact on the rest of the country, and it has become a solid pillar in the creation of Rainbow Nation. The South African nation is called Rainbow Nation because of the mix of many cultures. The three cultural pillars of Durban are the Zulu culture, the Indian culture, and the culture influenced by European settlers. And because of that, whole province, KwaZulu-Natal province, is considered to be the most beautiful, interesting, and culturally diverse of all the nine provinces of South Africa. It's for generation inhabited by Zulus, who since the 19th century strengthened their position, and to this day are the most dominant group of the province. So that's, I can say that first, or one of the third pillars, Zulu culture, can be, the culture can be visually described as multicolored, which fits perfectly with the common name of South Africa, Rainbow Nation. The Zulu people make up 22% of over 50 million inhabitants in the whole country. They live mostly concentrated between Johannesburg and Durban, but mostly in KwaZulu-Natal province. Their language is the most popular in South Africa. We have to remember that South Africa has 11 official languages. So the Zulu is the most popular and it's most spoken, either as a first or second or third language. It's used by over 11.5 million people nationwide. Zulus treat their culture with great respect. They cherish the oldest rituals, preserving their tradition, organizing various kinds of ceremonies. They deeply believe in the spiritual presence of ancestors, and through birth, marriage, and funeral ceremonies provide an opportunity to communicate with them in a spiritual way. So that's the Zulu culture. The other one is influenced by European settlers, and it dates back to the medieval times, where the first European who reached that part of the world, it was end of 15th century. That was Bartolomeo Dias, the Portuguese sailor. He sailed to Cape of Good Hope. Then a few years later, during Christmas season, Vasco da Gama reached the exactly Natal area. And because it was on Christmas time, he called the land Natal, which means Christmas in Portuguese. Mm. And this name obviously remains unchanged to this day and has become part of the main province, KwaZulu-Natal. In the times of apartheid regime in Durban and in the whole South Africa, many Europeans began to settle. There was like lots of migrants coming from different European countries, including Greeks, Italians, Portuguese, Poles, who still contribute new cultural elements into the city's rich history. European cultural elements are the most noticeable on the, for example, culinary level, and also thanks to the presence of diplomatic missions from European countries and the organization of exhibitions, concerts, and other cultural events. So that's the second pillar of the Durban multicultural being, and the third one, or the first one, is Indian. So multiculturalism of Durban manifests itself in the interpretation of that three main cultures: a rich and dominant Zulu, Hindu, and European culture. All these three pillars of the city are equally supported by government and local authorities. Now, this is how Indians found themselves in that place in Durban in South Africa. They, after arrival in 19th and 20th century, they became, I can say, salt of the future modern Indian community of South Africa. Although they are only a little over 3% of the South African population, their impact on the nation has been significant. Indians integrated with society, and despite the constant blending with the South African strongly imposing culture, they retained their unique identity. Today, they say about themselves, they are South Africans. They like to be associated with that multicultural being of South Africa.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to throw in very, very quickly, I don't need just a little bit of a summing up then on an absolutely fascinating topic. How would you say today the Indian diaspora, how they live their lives in South Africa now? Are they an integrated community? Have things improved for them? Obviously, they've had some struggles along with the apartheid and things like that. Are they community that is well grounded in their standing in South Africa?
Yes, they are. After so many generations, six or so generations, they perfectly blended into African reality. Mm. They are part of a nation. Obviously, all of them, all nation is struggling due to economic and or other problems. Yeah. But if we can talk about equality between different race groups, they are the same, having access to education, healthcare. They equally work in different levels of life. So yes, they are strong part of the nation. And
Teresa, that was absolutely fascinating. I've learned so much in this session. That there's so much I didn't have any clue about. So thank you so much for coming on for us today, Teresa. And Marcus and myself will be signing off, and I'm sure you'll hear from us at some point, listeners, in the future. So thank you, Teresa, and
thanks for joining us on History Hack.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I really enjoyed. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. It was really interesting, and hopefully we'll hear from you.
Thank you.
You can help us at History Hack by joining us via Patreon. It takes quite a lot of effort and a lot of work of quite a big team now to keep us going. And so if you could donate as little as £3 a month, it would be massively appreciated by all of us. There's different levels because Princess Marcus has set it all up with varying rewards and things. So do have a look. Do join us. There's an exclusive Facebook group as well, and you can be part of all of it.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hackhistory, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great